Okay, well, I'm going to admit that, first of all, I'm going to start off with a little bit of depressing topics. Okay, I'm just going to get that out of the way. But I promise it won't stay depressing the whole time. But we are living in a time where we find ourselves as a society where many people are having a kind of crisis of doubt, right? People seem not to know what to believe or whom to trust. And as many of you know, according to some of the most recent public opinion polls, despite an overwhelming consensus in the scientific community about that anthropogenic climate change is happening and that it's likely to have pretty catastrophic effects, only about 52% of the American public agrees. Also, the measles, a disease that once was eradicated, right, from the United States, was eradicated as recently as 2000, is starting to come back as people are starting to question and doubt whether vaccines are potentially safe and effective. 2009, this year, was actually the highest incident rate of new cases of measles in the world and also in the U.S. So the states that are all in blue here are states where we currently have measles cases. And actually, you know, I updated this map from July, but just today I found out that indeed we have to now add Washington, the District of Columbia, to the map. So people are vaccinating their children in lower rates, and it's definitely having an impact on public health. Evolutionary theory. This is a 2018 Pew Research Center poll. About 33% of those polled in the U.S. believe in evolution by natural processes. That number actually increases quite a bit. It's only 18% that reject evolution altogether. And many more people are willing to believe in evolution so long as they view that as not necessarily inconsistent with their deeply held religious beliefs. The Flat Earth Society. Okay. So it took, you know, the Flat Earth Society about 50 years or to gain about 3,500 members worldwide until the invention of the internet. So since 2000, the Flat Earth Society has actually grown exponentially. They now have, they have YouTube videos that literally get millions of views. Their website gets 300,000 unique visits every day. And their Facebook posts get hundreds of thousands of likes. Also very troubling, right? In 2017, Edgar Madison Welsh, 29 years old, drove to a Cosmic Pizzeria in Washington, D.C. with three guns, convinced that he was going to save the children who were being abused in a sex ring operation run by Hillary Clinton. Okay. And if you really believe that was happening, right, and that nobody was doing anything about it. But unfortunately, he did fire an military assault rifle into the restaurant, understandably terrifying patrons and workers there, before realizing that there were no children in the basement. He later surrendered to police and admitted that his intel had been kind of iffy. So... let that, I guess, be a lesson. But the question that all of these cases pose, and it's actually a very serious question, is what is it to believe responsibly? That is, how can we believe responsibly in a way that's based on good evidence, in a way that's based on sufficient evidence, and also after carefully considering the possibility that we might actually be wrong? Right? So, and this is the question that a lot of my scholarship and teaching and service on campus really tries to kind of aim to address, to think about, to help others think about, and to develop some of the skills in others. Now, before I go to the next slide, I apologize because I did not know this was going to be such fresh, sensitive news. I know this is a case that is painful for a lot of people to talk about and makes a lot of people on both sides of the political aisle angry. But it's just going to be a couple minutes, I promise. Okay, so in 2018, in September, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford testified before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee that she was 100% certain, okay, 100% certain, that then nominee for the Supreme Court, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, had sexually assaulted her along with his friend Mark Judge when they had been in high school in 1982. Dr. Ford, also herself a clinical psychologist, professor of clinical psychology at Stanford University, testified about why it is that victims of sexual assault and harassment often remember details of their assault so clearly, and after many years, while other details less so. Okay. Justice Brett Kavanaugh also testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And he testified that he was 100% certain, again, 100% certain, that he did not assault either Dr. Ford or anyone. So this obviously raises a question. I mean, quite a few people in the public had to decide, you know, who do we believe? What do we believe? And also quite a few senators weren't even sure what to believe. Nonetheless, the Republican-led Senate Judiciary Committee, including Chairman Chuck Grassley, concluded that there was no, quote, compelling evidence that Brett Kavanaugh, of any of the allegations of assault against him. Chuck Grassley also said in another quote, there was no corroborating evidence, which is also what the FBI concluded. So, but this raises a question, right? What counts as evidence? What do we take to be evidence for these sorts of claims? What counts as corroborating evidence? Presumably, Senator Grassley, who is from my home state of Iowa, but presumably Senator Grassley believes that, it seemed as though he thought only evidence of maybe like a neutral third party who had witnessed the attack or some kind of something like that would count as evidence. Obviously, lots of liberals and some independents really disagreed with that and thought that indeed there was some collaborating evidence, right? Dr. Ford had submitted to a polygraph test. She had submitted affidavits from people about whom she had described the attack years earlier. Does that count as evidence, right, or not? So no matter what you believe about this case, I think at least illustrates why these questions of what counts as evidence is actually really important. This case also raises questions about how much evidence we need to believe particular claims. So in the criminal system, we have a really high bar, right? Guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's because the consequences of error, of being wrong, of falsely accusing someone, of falsely believing that they did something they didn't, are pretty severe, right? I mean, you know, we're in the criminal system, we're looking at potentially locking up people for life, or in some cases, worse. And so, we need a lot of evidence. In the civil system, we have a lower bar for what counts as sufficient evidence for believing something or for holding someone accountable. And Senator Susan Collins of Maine actually thought this was a more appropriate standard to use, more likely than not to have done something. Some people argued at the time that these hearings were going on that actually even that was kind of too high of a bar in this case, that the decision in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee was a question about whether or not to promote someone, right, to the highest court in the land. And so one might think that the consequences of error in that case wouldn't be so grave. Presumably somebody else with similar judicial philosophy would have been appointed. Nonetheless, and I think it's important to mention, Brett Kavanaugh did talk about how this has harmed his reputation, harmed his family. It looks like we're going to be hearing more about this in the days to come. But I do think that this case raises these really important questions. And they're philosophical questions. They're questions that philosophers study, investigate, are trained to think about, to come up with accounts of. And they're questions of a field that we call epistemology. So this is the only jargon tonight, I promise. But epistemology is the study of knowledge. It's the study of knowledge concepts. It's the study of our knowledge practices. And they include these questions like, what do we count as evidence? What counts as good evidence, right? How much evidence do we need? Whom do we trust? Whom do we believe? What counts as reliable information? But what I also want to point out is that these epistemological questions are also really deeply connected to certain ethical questions, right? They're connected to questions about how do we want to treat other people? How do we want to treat people that we disagree with? What is it to be virtuous in our knowledge practices? And what are the consequences of being wrong? Which one of those are worse? And those are value judgments. So these are questions that philosophers study. They're questions that I study. And I hope to convince you by the end of tonight that they're skills that we should all learn and have more of. I also just wanted to point out, before talking much more about my own research, that I'm obviously not the only person here at MSU studying these questions. We have a small but very robust and vibrant philosophy group of philosophers at MSU. And, you know, philosophy kind of has a bad rap, I think. I blame it on Descartes, personally. But, you know, this idea that somehow we kind of, like, sit by the fire and, like, think these deep, big, abstract thoughts that have really nothing to do with the world. My colleague, Dr. Prashanto Bandyopadhyay, is a philosopher of science also in epistemology. He does work in Bayesian theory and works on concepts like probability and uncertainty. And he works on those issues from everything from climate models to being able to model the success rates of certain treatments on disease. My colleague Dan Flory is actually currently, right now, mentoring one of our undergraduate students in an honors thesis that's about how online technologies and social media are potentially changing our conceptions of friendship, right? And potentially changing our interactions with other people and ourselves. And that undergraduate student, Mike Wright, is going to be presenting his honors thesis work at the Conference for Undergraduate Research this spring. And our very newest member, Bonnie Sheehy, who just joined our department this year, also does incredibly interesting work on philosophy of technology and ethics. And in particular, she's worked on algorithms and the ways in which algorithms can impact our practices and particularly certain disadvantaged groups. So, you know, this is not your grandfather's philosophy anymore, right? All right. I did want to talk a little bit briefly about how I became a philosopher. And I think, you know, so here I am, this is age two, this is age six. I think this is, you know, the beginning of my thinker's pose. But I, like many kids, I was one of those kids that kind of always asked why about a lot of things, right? Why is the sky blue? How do you know that when you see green and I see green, we see the same thing, right? And children actually have this amazing ability to wonder about these questions. And actually, many times they aren't expecting an answer. And luckily, I had a family that kind of indulged me in this. So I also, this is a little embarrassing, my mother sent me this photo. I also grew up in the community theater and show choir, and this was less embarrassing than the show choir pictures, actually. I'm one of the sheep. I'm actually the sheep that's over here. But I think perhaps that my experience in theater, as you know, growing up, maybe gave me some perspective on trying to get into other people's shoes, into other characters, or hooves, I guess, in this case. This was a production of Charlotte's Web. But you know, thinking about the world and how it is from a different perspective and different characters. I also think that a lot of why I kind of became interested in the particular questions that I did really was influenced by my family. So I have a really, really diverse, weird, strange, blended, wonderful family. My parents were actually first generation college students. So my dad, this is my dad, Jerry, and this is my Uncle Bob. They both were the first people in their family to go to college, and they both ended up with advanced degrees in physics. So 1968 was the year that my father earned his PhD from Stevens Institute of Technology in physics. My Uncle Bob had actually already graduated a couple years before that and was already an assistant professor of physics at Temple University, where he spent his entire career. My mother actually came from a family that moved around the Mountain West a bunch as a kid growing up. They moved around a lot. That's my mom as a precocious four-year-old. And actually, she's back here in this one with my grandpa Roger and grandmother Doris. And my mom studied English, so she was a humanist at the University of Colorado Boulder. And then she went on at the University SUNY Binghamton to study special education. She was interested in special education for special needs kids. But my mom, like many women of her generation, actually never quite finished school, and she also even never quite entered the workforce when she was that age, because she got married and she really devoted herself to having and raising three children. And so, you know, that I had a stay-at-home mom. She played a big role in my life. So when I was young, we were growing up, my dad moved us when he got a job at the University of Northern Iowa. So I grew up in this house in Cedar Falls, Waterloo. I admit I had to get this picture off Google Maps and it's really bad. But that is indeed the house. But my parents actually divorced in 1984. And really it presented challenges for both my parents. So my dad was suddenly, you know, by that point, I think he was department chair of physics at the University of Northern Iowa. And he now suddenly had a household and three kids to run. At the time, I'll admit, he didn't even know how to use a washing machine. My mom had to kind of re-enter the workforce after, you know, her education was already several years old. She didn't have work experience to draw on. And it was a pretty huge struggle for my family. I remember the first apartment that my mom had was a studio apartment that didn't have a kitchen but had a hot plate. So it was a few tough years. She soon remarried and moved into this trailer court with my stepfather, who was a dispatcher for a trucking company in Waterloo. So myself and my brothers, we grew up kind of in two different worlds, right? So we grew up half the week at our house in Cedar Falls, which was this kind of academic community, and then we spent the other half of the week in this trailer park in nearby Waterloo. So my brothers actually also kind of took off in different directions. So my brother Jeremy did indeed both take the science track and the academic track. And he's now an assistant professor of chemistry at University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. My brother Jonathan didn't want anything to do at all with the world of academia. And he was really drawn to machines. So he worked as a car mechanic for a while, and now he works and has for several years at Tyson Meatpacking Plant as a machinist there. So I have this really economically kind of socially diverse family in terms of both our backgrounds and the kinds of professions that we chose. People may not know this about me, but I also have an ethnically diverse family. So my sister Tyra, who's over here on the left, she was adopted into our family when she and I were both 16. We had been longtime friends. She's the only one of us siblings who has been brave enough and strong enough to have to bring children into the world. And so thank goodness for her, because I have two wonderful nephews, Dontarius and Kaleem. Also, and some people I do know this, but my husband, Pablo, is from Spain, he immigrated to Bozeman from Spain. We speak Spanish at home and English in public, and sometimes a really weird mix, but... And also, I do just want to say, because really he has supported me through all kinds of things, including having debate meetings with my students on Sundays. And so I really couldn't do a lot of the work I do without his support and encouragement. His family in Spain, I got this great new other extended family in another country, including our nephews, Christian and Nico. You know, again, his family only speaks Spanish, my family only speaks English, and so we have to kind of operate as translators a lot of times, but somehow it all works out. My family is also really politically diverse. So a lot of my relatives in Spain are Roman Catholic. They are staunch social conservatives. My mom, Ellie, is actually an evangelical Christian, though she also, interestingly, is a strong supporter of LGBTQ rights. She is for reproductive rights, and she cares really deeply about the environment. This is actually my uncle Scott and my aunt Connie, and their son Scott James, who's my cousin. They are hunting and bow shooting enthusiasts. In fact, they have an archery kind of shop. They make their own strings. They are gun enthusiasts. They are Trump supporters. They are climate skeptics. Okay. My stepfather, who is Scott's brother, has always kind of been something of a kind of, you know, hippie liberal, conscientious objector, and is not a Trump supporter, okay? Okay. And then finally, my stepmother, Chris, she grew up in rural Indiana. She loves fishing. She was an oncology nurse for a long time. But she also actually participated in the Women's March in Washington, D.C. She drove to Washington, D.C. to participate there. My dad, I have to say, because he's been a really big, important role model in my life. My dad, one of my most cherished memories of him was him in 1998, standing on a street corner in the pouring rain with a sign imploring Iowans to vote for the Iowa Equal Rights Amendment after it had already failed twice. And I'm pretty sure that there were other members of my family on the opposite street corner at that same time. My dad has really devoted his life to academia. As I mentioned, he was a professor of physics, he was a department chair, he was a dean, and eventually he retired just a couple of years ago as a provost of Indiana University, Pennsylvania. He has also, and sometimes even in moments when I wasn't super excited to hear it, has really given me the perspective of an administrator. why certain decisions are kind of made the way that they are. I have to admit, it's definitely broadened my perspective. So it turns out even the animals in our family are politically divided. My parents actually named their dogs, Yanks and this is Sox, named after my parents' two different competing baseball teams, the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox. So as you might imagine, right, with all of these differences, we do not have the easiest of family gatherings. My family is as loud as they are opinionated, and they have very strong opinions. But somehow, these are all people that all throughout my life, right, have loved me, have supported me, and even kind of tolerated me when I really asked them why they believe what they believe. And so I think that really made an impact on me because I didn't have the privilege, I guess, or the option of just kind of thinking, okay, these people are crazy or these people are evil. But I was really, really developed a curiosity about why different members of my family believed so differently. And luckily, they put up with me. So I was an undergraduate at the University of Iowa. I started off as a political science major. I ended up adding a philosophy major in large part thanks to Diane Jeskes, who's actually still at the University of Iowa, and her political philosophy and her ethics courses, which completely excited me. She really encouraged me. She was the only tenure-track female professor at the time. And so this is something that maybe a lot of people don't know about philosophy, but we're kind of weirdos in the humanities. For some weird reason, right, we have pretty bad numbers when it comes to diversity in philosophy. So this is a chart just looking at PhDs awarded to women by field. Philosophy is actually this black line, right, across the middle. 2004, which was the year I graduated with my PhD, is actually where this little spike is. And that's the highest it's ever been, and it hasn't been that high since then, and has actually been going down. And you can kind of see that we've kind of flatlined. And it's also, should mention, even though it's even more depressing, but our numbers for racial diversity in philosophy are even worse, right? So a lot of the gains that have been made by women in philosophy have been made by white women. But you can see how different this is from the rest of the humanities, which is this blue line here, right? And then, you know, the social sciences, this green, life sciences in yellow. We're about on par with some of the physical sciences and a little bit above engineering. But what's a little discouraging for philosophers about this graph is that you notice we're kind of flatlined, right? I mean, engineering's on the way up, man. They got their act together. They're doing something right. Admittedly, we have fewer resources to address some of these challenges. And why this is the case is no doubt an incredibly complicated story with many, many variables that are difficult to understand, difficult to counter. But it wasn't easy for me as an undergraduate. I was usually the only undergraduate female in most of my classes. There was one other woman, Agello Repis, who weirdly was from my high school. But she and I, sometimes we had the same classes together and sometimes we didn't. It was kind of a tough road to hoe. It got better when I went to graduate school, but you know, these are things that we think about now in our teaching here at MSU and what we can do to become a more inclusive discipline. So, okay, now I'm going to talk a little bit about some of my research and about some of the work I've done with my collaborator, Inmaculada de Melo-Martin. This was our recent book, which looked at this question of how do we bridge the gap between scientists and the public. And there are many possible reasons why this gap exists, right? So some people think it's a lack of understanding of science. The research seems to suggest that's not the case, especially when you look at certain issues like vaccines and vaccine hesitation. A lot of the people that aren't vaccinating their children are actually highly educated. So that's not the whole story. Clearly, we have this increasing sense of tribalism, and there's a lot of social scientists that have done research showing that certain issues like climate change become really politicized in ways where people kind of dig in and say, you know, my team is for this or my team is against that, kind of regardless of the evidence. We also, regardless of what side of the political aisle we're on, we all are susceptible to certain cognitive biases, right? And in some cases, we're prone to confirmation bias, where we tend to kind of cherry pick the evidence in ways that support the views we want to maintain, and we tend to downplay or ignore evidence that goes against those views. That's always the case. Clearly, in some cases, there's also powerful, you know, private and corporate interests that are also, and big tobacco is one obvious example, where they're deliberately trying to create doubt and uncertainty about the science, right? Attacking the science in order to stall regulations. And that's a part of it too. We also we also have technology being weaponized, right, and trying to trick us. So this is actually a deepfake technology video that I believe was made at MIT, if I'm remembering correctly, and where here you have, you know, Nicolas Cage's face kind of grafted on right to Trump's body, but in ways that make the lips and everything look like exactly like Trump. You can obviously imagine what the consequences might be if, you know, Trump was morphed onto somebody else, and you can kind of make them say whatever they want to say. Indeed, we also saw how social media is being weaponized to try to make us believe things that are potentially false. So, okay, now's hopefully the hopeful part of the talk, right? So what can we do to promote responsible belief and action? As Mary mentioned, one of the things that we're trying to do here at MSU is this new initiative for science, technology, ethics, and society. And one of the big goals of that center, in addition to generating research on these topics, is also in increasing the engagement between researchers, scientists, engineers, and community members, right, and the public. in ways that might perhaps better facilitate trust, in ways that might help members of the public understand the kind of research that's being done and the kind of evidence that scientists rely on, and might also help scientists understand some of the needs and concerns of the public as well. In this effort, I also have five fabulous co-directors, associate directors: Beth Burrows from math, Marianne Cummings from computer science, Brock Lemires from electrical and computer engineering, Michael Reedy from history, and Blake Wiedenhoff from microbiology and immunology. And then we also have like this gigantic faculty board, a faculty advisory board of about 15 people from departments and colleges across campus. And so we're really excited to start doing some things that will help address some of these issues. One of the things that we're doing in relation to the center is that we've developed this course called Calling BS. It's modeled on a course that was developed at the University of Washington by Carl Bergstrom and Jevin West. Some of you may have seen Jevin West talk last spring. Yeah, hopefully, maybe. This is a non-credit course offered to the public. I taught it for the first time last spring. It looks like, I think I can announce that I'm going to be teaching it again this spring, actually this time for Wanderlust. So if you're interested, check it out. And we'll be going into much more details and how you can identify fake news and that sort of thing. But, you know, as I was preparing this talk, and I'm not kidding, I was preparing this talk, and I got a little ding on my phone, and I opened it up, and there in my Google News feed was this story. I get a lot of weird suggestions from Google, I think, because I do some kind of strange searches, I admit. So the headline of this said, "New scientific paper proves clouds control the climate, not man." Who knew, right? And indeed, you know, it talks about how there's this new paper published in Nature, which, you know, is one of the top peer-reviewed journals in science, if not the top, right? So now this is the little bit of audience interaction I had planned. So I want to ask, and particularly those of you that don't have advanced degrees in science, please, if you got this in your Google News feed, I mean, what do you do? How do you evaluate this information? Is there anything about this article that at least might make you initially skeptical? Okay, first thing, somebody said, the fact that it says proves, right? So that's even if you don't have time to click on the link or investigate this stuff, this immediately also drew my attention. Because, you know, science really isn't in the business of proving things 100% true or proving things 100% false, and certainly not one study, right? Science is a process where we're generating evidence and getting evidence from multiple different sources, multiple different disciplines, using different sorts of techniques and methodologies. So you can contribute evidence to that body of evidence, but it seems very strange that they would claim that. And typically, no scientist makes quite such a bold claim, right? They're very careful. Anything else that might make you skeptical, or anything you might do to check out the veracity of this? Checking out the author's name, right? So like, who is that? What's Capilano? That doesn't even sound like a real name, right? So who is that person? What else could you do to check it out?
Nature.
You could check Nature. So that's what I did, right? Because I thought, wow, is this really in Nature? So I go on the Nature, I go out of social media, right? I go onto the computer, I check Nature, and I can't find this paper. So then I go back and I click on the link, and I don't think you had it here, but you could click on the link for the paper. It turns out, just so that you know, when I pulled up the paper, the name Nature was not at the bottom with the journal and the volume and all of that, so I was suspicious. Where it was indeed published, and this is a real paper, it was published in archive.org. Does anybody know what that is? So it's an open source place where researchers can, in fact, publish their work online, but it has not been peer reviewed, right? I was also kind of skeptical because, like, the date on this news story was actually the same as the date on the paper, which I thought, wow, that was fast, right? So clearly, you know, this was kind of a case where, I wish I got a book review that fast, but, you know, clearly this was a case where they had kind of an advanced thing of this paper and they presented it in this way. Now, I'm not going to debate the science in this paper, but I will say if you're interested, you can indeed Google this and you can go and you can read the comments where both climate scientists and skeptics are having quite a lively debate about it. I'll leave that there. Okay, so I want to give just two more quick examples. I want to come back actually to this deepfake technology video. So there's one way, at least with our current deepfake technology, and this is scary because it's changing and getting better very, very quickly. But if you look at the eyes, right? So one thing that AI and computer-generated technologies cannot do very well is mimic natural eye blinking, right? So if you notice, Nicolas Cage over here is not really blinking at all, right? And not like the real thing. So there's just one little handy practical tip when you're looking at videos. But of course, it is really kind of a race between researchers and those that want to use the technology to trick people to see who can outdo who. So this is actually similar to, this is from a site that was created by Carl Bergstrom and Jevon West. So one of these, this is from a site called Which Face is Real, right? So one of these pictures is computer generated. So let me just get by a show of hands, how many people think that this face on the left is computer generated? How many people? Have to raise your hand or not, right? How many people think this face on the right is computer generated? Okay, so it turns out this is the computer generated face. How can you tell? So teeth are actually one of the getaways is you can really look because teeth are actually really difficult for computer generated images to create. And sometimes they do weird things like have three incisors or something, right? What else is weird? The what? The background. Yeah, so on computer-generated images, especially of faces, the backgrounds tend to be weird. So here, I don't even know what this is. Sometimes there's like a little watermark. In this case, the other telltale sign is that the background, if you notice, is kind of bleeding into her hair over here. And so her hair is kind of turning green. So once you kind of know what some of the kind of telltale signs are, it actually becomes relatively easy to distinguish fake from real faces. But of course, this is just going to be an increasing challenge as the technology develops. The other telltale sign here, I'll just show, they get symmetry poor, right? So notice she also has on two different earrings. Now I admit, again, sometimes I think I probably have come to work like that, but all right. Okay, so I want to end just by talking a little bit about the current direction of my research. I'm currently doing work on a project, what's being called virtue epistemology. So thinking about what are the kind of character traits that we want to kind of instill both in ourselves and in others and in things like our academic communities and institutions, what are the sorts of virtues that we want to create or instill in people that will help people to be more likely to believe responsibly. And these are things like epistemic humility, which I think is really important. And I think it's hard for us because we always like to think it's other people that, you know, have those cognitive biases and, you know, get taken in by fakes and whatnot or quickly likely to believe, but not me, right? But really embracing the possibility that we might be wrong, even about some of our most deeply cherished views and being open to new evidence. Having curiosity to understand why other people believe the things they do, and also what are some of the other perspectives or new lines of evidence that we might pursue to be able to do things. Creativity, being able to think of alternative explanations for things. Charity, interpreting those that we disagree with in ways that make their views sound as plausible as possible, right? Even though we might be disinclined to do so. And really having respect for the views of other people and not assuming that they're crazy or that they're idiots, but that they're other human beings that have some reasons for believing what they do. And having critical trust. So, I mean, we have to trust each other in order to believe things, right? No lone human can go through the world rediscovering everything that's ever been known or proven by themselves. They have to rely on the testimony of others. They have to rely on the previous scientific work of others, right? Even scientists. But making sure that we're trusting in the right, with the, you know, right sources and reliable information, as opposed to just kind of trusting blindly. And so I'll conclude by saying, you know, if you think about, I mean, those virtues are important because when we look at conspiracy theorists, for example, right, flat earth, you know, we tend to think, right, that they're crazy. People often think that. And some of the character traits that a lot of conspiracy theorists have is a sense of isolation, a sense of alienation, a sense that they don't fit in, right? A distrust of authority, which isn't always bad, you know. And, you know, the thing is that they end up kind of pulling back because they don't want to be treated as crazy. And indeed, and this is no joke, I'm not kidding, they've now created their own dating websites, which apparently aren't even heteronormative. But, you know, because they feel like they can't even date other people that aren't also, don't also believe in flat earth because they're going to be attacked, right? And so when that kind of thing starts happening and we stop talking to people and we stop talking to people we disagree with, I worry greatly that that kind of really ingrains and instantiates the kinds of, you know, individual alienation and isolation that leads to not being able to put a check on some of our own biases. So these are the virtues that that I've been thinking about, that my work is aimed at trying to develop. They're the virtues that I also have been trying to develop in some of my own students. This is my 2017 Ethics Bowl debate team, the Ethicats. And they have to prepare to argue all sides of issues, even when they disagree with their own views. You know, I will say my hopeful note is working with these students, because these are students who also believe very passionately, believe very strongly, but are really willing to listen to each other and really eager to learn from each other. And so hopefully maybe they can teach us something about that. So thank you. Thank you very much. So questions, comments? Yeah. Not an easy question to answer, actually. So the question was, is peer review a good way to rely on this? I mean, so in climate change debate, for example, there has been this big distinction between peer-reviewed studies versus those that are not. On the one hand, peer review, when it works well, indeed is one way of really trying to make sure that what's being published, that the quality and the content and the reliability of it is high, right? But there are indeed flaws with the peer review process. It's important that we be kind of honest about that, right? And think about how we can better those. One of the complaints that some climate skeptics have about peer review is that the papers tend to go to reviewers who are experts in the field, and the experts in the field are always usually likely to have the consensus view, whatever that is, right? And so some have argued that it's harder to get a fair shake. So thinking about how we can improve some of those processes could be important. So thinking about some of those virtues, right? You know, I think that we also all have limited time, right? We want to be open to other views, but if other people aren't open, right, either, then that's very difficult. But, you know, I will say I had a really weird cab ride with, actually, it was not just a flat earther, but somebody who believed in all, I mean, I think literally every conspiracy theory that exists, this guy believed in it. And so I found it really difficult to engage with him and have, you know, I wasn't going to try to argue the other side, but actually I just listened to him. And at the end of the conversation, he was like, I can't believe you just listened to me. You know, no one ever does that. And, you know, they think I'm crazy. And I'm like, well, you know, all I would ask is that, you know, you think about this, that. I mean, I was kind of a little bit gentle. So it really depends on the context, right? And you do have to think about where can you put your time and where can't you. But establishing trust, knowing that you're listening, might also make others more eager to know about why you believe what you believe. So... Well, and the problem is that often the people who are pushing these sorts of things are people that have power and people that have resources. And so how to address that is a bigger, deeper social political problem, how we do that. So in some ways, I think the most promising ways are to try to arm ourselves, right? One piece of advice, for whatever it's worth, no one's going to listen to me about this, but is don't get your news from social media, right? A lot of those artificial intelligence programs that are running to try to kind of disseminate these things and put things in your news source, they're training through machine learning to try to get hits, to try to get what they call user engagement, user interaction. And it turns out that the one thing that engages human beings to click, to forward, to share more than anything is anger. So that's also shaping, right, the content of things that are coming into our news feeds. I mean, it kind of did work with me, I admit too. But yeah, yeah, you have a follow up? That's a good question, right? How do we engage our peers? How to kind of think about these things? I mean, my experience has been that on these topics, people are very engaged and interested and care. But I do think it's about having the right tools to be able to engage with that. And so doing things also, I mean, in an academic setting, but also in non-academic settings where we can have conversations about this and teach people certain kind of basic critical thinking things. How will democracy survive the internet? Well, actually, I might pass that question off to my colleague Bonnie Sheehy, or Tim LaCaine, right? Isn't Tim LaCaine teaching a class right now on whether or not technology is going to destroy us all? So, I'll give a short answer. I don't know, but I do have some belief in the perseverance of democracy.